Stay and keep watch. Do not let Hank's life be touched. But aside from that, prevent nothing. It will be a test he must undergo." There was a slight moment of surprise and wonderment, but each warrior was ready to trust Tal's judgment. Tal continued, "As for Marshal Hogan, he's the only one I'm not sure about yet. Rhaefar will give his lackeys incredible license with him, and he could either collapse and retreat, or, as we all hope, rouse himself and fight back. He'll be of special interest to Rhaefar, and to me, tonight. Gailo, select 2 warriors for yourself and 2 for me. We'll watch care over Marshal tonight and see how he responds. The rest of you will search out the remnant." Tal drew his sword and held it high. The others did the same, and a forest of shining blades appeared, held aloft in strong arms. "Rhaefar," Tal said in a low, musing voice, "we meet again." Then in the voice of a captain of the host, "For the saints of God and for the Lamb! For the saints of God and for the Lamb!" they echoed. Complacency unfurled his wings and drifted into Stuart Hall, sinking down through the main floor and into the catacombs of the basement level, the area set aside for administration and the private offices of the psychology department. In this dismal nether world, the ceiling was low and oppressive, and crawling with water pipes and heat ducts that seemed like so many huge snakes waiting to drop. Everything, walls, ceiling, pipes, woodwork, was painted the same dirty beige, and light was scarce, which suited Complacency and his associates just fine. They preferred the darkness, and Complacency noticed that there seemed to be a touch more than usual. The others must have arrived. He floated down a long burrow of a hallway to a large door at the end marked Conference Room, and passed through the door into a cauldron of living evil. The room was dark, but the darkness seemed more of a presence than a physical condition. It was a force, an atmosphere that drifted and crept about the room. Out of that darkness glared many pairs of dull yellow cat eyes, belonging to a horrible gallery of grotesque faces. The various shapes of Complacency's fellow workers were outlined and backlit by a sourceless red glow. Yellow vapor slithered in lacy wisps about the room and filled the air with its stench as the many apparitions carried on their hushed, gargling conversations there in the dark. Complacency could sense their common disdain for him, but the feeling was mutual enough. These belligerent egotists would walk on anyone to exalt themselves, and Complacency just happened to be the smallest, hence the easiest to persecute. He approached 2 hulking forms in the middle of some debate, and from their massive spine-covered arms and poisonous words, he could tell they were demons who specialized in hate, planting, aggravating, and spreading it, using their crushing arms and venomous quills to constrict and poison the love out of anyone. Complacency asked them, "Where is Prince Lucius?"
"Find him yourself, lizard," one of them growled.
A demon of lust, a slithery creature with darting and shifty eyes and slippery hide, overheard and joined in, snatching Complacency with his long, sharp talons.
"And where have you been sleeping today?" it asked with a sneer. "I do not sleep," Complacency retorted. "I cause people to sleep." "To lust and steal innocence is far better. But someone must turn away the eyes of others."
Lust thought that over and gave a smirk of approval. He dropped Complacency rudely as those who watched laughed. Complacency passed deception, but didn't bother to ask him anything. Deception was the proudest, haughtiest demon of them all, very arrogant in his supposedly superior knowledge of how to control men's minds. His appearance was not even as gruesome as the other demons. He almost looked human. His weapon, he boasted, was always a compelling, persuasive argument, with lies ever so subtly woven in. Many others were there. Murder, his talons still dripping with blood. Lawlessness, his knuckles honed into spike-like protrusions and his hide thick and leathery. Jealousy, as suspicious and difficult a demon to work with as any. But complacency finally found Lucius, the Prince of Ashton, the demon who held the highest position of all of them. Lucius was in conference with a tight huddle of other power-holders, going over the next strategies for controlling the town. He was unquestionably the demon in charge. Huge to begin with, he always maintained an imposing posture with his wings wrapped loosely around him to widen his outline, his arms flexed, his fists clenched and ready for blows. Many demons coveted his rank, and he knew it. He had fought and banished many to get where he was, and he had every intention of staying there. He trusted no one and suspected everyone. And his black, gnarled face and hawk-sharp eyes always carried the message that even his associates were his enemies. Complacency was desperate and enraged enough to violate Lucius's ideas of respect and decorum. He shoved his way through the group and right up to Lucius, who glared at him, surprised by the rude interruption.
"My prince," Complacency pleaded, "I must have a word with you."
Lucius's eyes narrowed. Who was this little lizard to interrupt him in the middle of a conference, to violate decorum in front of these others?
"Why aren't you with Hogan?" he growled.
"I must speak with you."
"Dare you speak to me without my first speaking to you?"
"It is vitally important. You're making a mistake. You're bothering Hogan's daughter, and—"
Lucius immediately became a small volcano, spewing forth horrible cursings and wrath.
"You accuse your prince of a mistake. You dare to question my actions."
Complacency cowered, expecting a stinging blow any moment. But he spoke anyway.
"Hogan will do us no harm if you let him alone. But you have only lit a fire within him, and he casts me off."
The blow came, a walloping swat from the back of Lucius's hand, and as Complacency tumbled across the room, he debated whether or not to speak another word. When he came to rest and regathered himself, he looked up to see every eye upon him, and he could feel their mocking disdain. Lucius walked slowly toward him and towered over him like a giant tree.
"Hogan casts you off. Is it not you who releases him?"
"Do not strike me. Only hear my appeal."
Lucius's big fists clenched painfully around handfuls of Complacency's flesh and snatched him up so they were eye to eye.
"He could stand in our way, and I won't have that. You know your duty. Perform it."
I was. Complacency cried. "He was nothing to fear at all, a slug, a lump of clay. I could have held him there forever."
"So do it."
"Prince Lucius, please hear me. Give him no enemy. Let him have no need to fight."
Lucius dropped him on the floor in a humiliated heap. The prince addressed the others in the room.
"We have given Hogan an enemy?"
They all knew how to answer.
"No, indeed."
"Deception,"
Lucius called, and Deception stepped forward, giving Lucius a formal bow.
"Complacency accuses his prince of bothering Hogan's daughter. You would know about that."
"You have ordered no attack on Sandy Hogan, prince,"
Deception answered. Complacency pointed his taloned finger and screamed,
"You have followed her, you and your lackeys. You have spoken words to her mind, confused her."
Deception only raised his eyebrows in mild indignation and answered sedately,
"Only upon her own invitation. We've only told her what she prefers to know. That can hardly be called an attack."
Lucius seemed to take on some of Deception's maddening haughtiness as he said,
"Sandy Hogan is one case, but certainly her father is quite another.
She poses no threat to us. He does. Shall we send someone else to hold him in check?
Complacency had no answer, but added another note of concern.
I saw messengers of the living God today.
That only brought laughter from the group. Lucius sneered.
Are you becoming that timid, Complacency? We see messengers of the living God every day. That day we're close, about to attack. They knew my actions, I'm sure.
You look all right to me. Though if I were one of them, I would surely pick you as an easy prey.
More laughter from the group spurred Lucius on.
A limp and easy target for mere sport. A lame demon with which a weak angel can prove his strength.
Complacency cowered in shame. Lucius strode about, addressing the group.
Do we fear the host of heaven? He asked.
As you do not, we do not,
they all answered with great polish. As the demons remained in their basement lair, patting each other's backs and stabbing complacencies, they took no notice of the strange, unnatural cold front outside. It moved slowly over the town, bringing a harsh wind and chilling rain. Though the evening had promised to be bright and clear, it now grew dark under a low, oppressive shroud, half-natural, half-spirit. Atop the little white church, Signa and his two companions continued to stand guard as the darkness descended over Ashton, deeper and colder with each passing moment. All over the nearby neighborhood, dogs began to bark and howl. Here and there, a quarrel broke out among humans.
"He's here," Signa said.
In the meantime, Lucius's preoccupation with his own glory kept him from noticing the little attention he was now getting from his troops. All the other demons in the room, large or small, were gripped by a steadily rising fear and agitation. They could all feel something horrible coming closer and closer. They began to fidget, their eyes darting about, their faces twisting with apprehension. Lucius gave Complacency a kick in the side as he walked by and continued his boasting.
"Complacency, you can be sure that we have things very much in control here. No worker from our numbers ever had to sneak about for fear of attack. We roam this town freely, doing our work unhampered, and we will succeed in every place until the town is fully ours. You listless, limp little bungler, to fear is to fail!"
Then it happened, and so very suddenly that none of them could react with anything other than air-piercing shrieks of terror. Lucius had hardly gotten the word fail out of his mouth before a violent, boiling cloud crashed and thundered into the room like a tidal wave, a sudden avalanche of force that crushed like iron. The demons were swept across the room like so much debris in a raging tide, tumbling, screaming, wrapping their wings tightly around themselves in terror, all except for Lucius. As the demons recovered from the initial shockwave of this new presence, they looked up and saw Lucius's body, contorted like a broken toy, in the grip of a huge black hand. He struggled, choked, gagged, cried for mercy, but the hand only tightened its crushing grip, inflicting punishment without mercy, descending down out of the darkness like a cyclone from a thundercloud. Then the full figure of a spirit appeared, carrying Lucius by the throat and shaking him about like a rag doll. The thing was bigger than any they had ever seen before, a giant demon with a lion-like face, fiery eyes, incredibly muscular body, and leathery wings that filled the room. The voice gargled up from deep within the demon's torso and sprayed out in clouds of fiery red vapor.
"You who have no fear, are you now afraid?"
The spirit angrily hurled Lucius across the room to join the others, then stood like a mountain in the center of the room, wielding a deadly S-curved sword the size of a door. Obviously, this prince of princes had been greatly honored for past victories. His jet-black hair hung like a mane to his shoulders, and on each wrist he wore a gold bracelet studded with sparkling stones. His fingers displayed several rings, and a ruby-red belt and scabbard adorned his waist. The expansive black wings draped down behind him now like the robe of a monarch. For an eternity he stood there, glaring at them with sinister smoldering eyes, studying them, and all they could do was remain motionless in their terror, like a macabre tableau of frightened goblins. Finally, the big voice echoed off the walls.
"Lucius, I feel I was not expected. You will announce me. On your feet!"
The sword moved across the room, and the tip snagged Lucius in the hide of his neck, jolting him to his feet. Lucius knew he was being belittled in the sight of his underlings, but he made every effort to hide his rising bitterness and anger. His fear showed well enough to adequately cover his other feelings.
"Fellow workers," he said, his voice quivering despite every effort, "Baal-Rephah, the Prince of Babylon."
Automatically, they all leaped to their feet, partly out of fearful respect, mostly out of fear of the tip of Rhaefar's sword, still waving slowly back and forth, ready to move against any dawdlers. Rhaefar gave them all a quick looking over. Then he inflicted another personal blow against Lucius.
"Lucius, you will stand with the others. I have come, and only one prince is needed."
Friction. Everyone could feel it immediately. Lucius refused to move. His body was stiff, his fist clenched as tightly as ever, and though he was visibly trembling, he purposely returned the glaring look of Rhaefar and stood his ground.
"You have not asked me to yield my place," he challenged.
The others were not about to intervene or even get close. They backed off, remembering that Rhaefar's sword could probably sweep a very wide radius. The sword did move, but so quickly that the very first thing anyone perceived was a scream of pain from Lucius as he coiled into a twisted knot on the floor. Lucius's sword and scabbard lay on the floor, skillfully cut away by one swift slash from Rhaefar. Again the sword moved, and this time the flat of the blade clamped Lucius to the floor by his hair. Rhaefar leaned over him, blood-red breath spewing from his mouth and nostrils as he spoke.
"I perceive you wish to challenge for my position."
Lucius said nothing.
"Answer!"
"No,"
Lucius cried.
"I yield."
"Up! Get up!"
Lucius struggled to his feet, and Rhaefar's strong arm stood him with the others. By now, Lucius was a most pitiful sight, totally humiliated. Rhaefar reached down with his sword, and with the barbed tip picked up Lucius's sword and scabbard. The sword swung like a huge crane and deposited Lucius's weapons in the deposed demon's hands.
"Listen well, all of you,"
Rhaefar addressed them.
"Lucius, who fears not the hosts of heaven, has shown fear. He is a liar and a worm and is not to be heeded. I say to you, fear the hosts of heaven. They are your enemies, and they are intent on defeating you. As they are ignored, as they are given place, so they shall overcome you."
Rhaefar walked with heavy, ponderous steps up and down the line of demons, giving them all a closer look. When he came to complacency, he drew close, and complacency fell backwards. Rhaefar caught him around the back of the neck with one finger and pulled him up straight.
"Tell me, little lizard, what did you see today?"
Complacency was suffering from a sudden memory lapse. Rhaefar prodded him.
"Messengers of the living God, you said?"
Complacency nodded.
"Where?"
"Just outside this building."
"What were they doing?"
I...
"Did they attack you?"
No.
"Was there a flash of light?"
That seemed to register with complacency. He nodded.
When a messenger of God attacks, there is always light.
Rhaefar addressed all of them angrily.
And you let it slip by. You laughed. You mocked. A near attack from the enemy, and you ignored it.
Now Rhaefar returned to grill Lucius some more.
Tell me, deposed prince, how stands the town of Ashton? Is it ready?
Lucius was quick to say,
Yes, Mayor Rhaefar.
Oh, then you have taken care of this praying bush and this sleeping troublemaker Hogan.
Lucius was silent.
You have not. First you allow them to come into places we reserved for our own special appointments.
It was a mistake, Bail Rhaefar, Lucius blurted. The Clarion editor was eliminated according to our orders, but no one knows where this Hogan came from. He bought the paper before anything could be done.
And Bush? It was my understanding that he fled from your attacks.
That was another man of God. The first one. He did flee.
And?
This younger man sprung up in his place. From nowhere.
A long, foul sigh hissed out through Rhaefar's fangs.
The host of heaven, he said. While you have taken them for granted, they have moved in the Lord's chosen right under your noses. It is no secret that Henry Bush is a man who prays. Do you fear that?
Lucius nodded.
Yes, of course, more than anything. We have been attacking him, trying to drive him out.
And how has he responded?
He...
Speak up!
He prays.
Rhaefar shook his head.
Yes, yes, he is a man of God. And what about Hogan? What have you done about him?
We have attacked his daughter.
Complacency's ears perked up at that.
His daughter?
But Complacency couldn't contain himself.
I told him it wouldn't work. It would only make Hogan more aggressive and wake him from his lethargy.
Lucius grabbed for Rhaefar's attention.
If my lord would allow me to explain.
Explain.
Rhaefar instructed Lucius while warily eyeing Complacency. Lucius quickly formulated a plan in his mind.
Sometimes a direct attack is not wise, so we found a weakness in his daughter and felt we could divert his energies toward her, perhaps destroy him at home and disintegrate his family. It seemed to work on the former editor. It was at least a start. It will fail, cried Complacency. He was harmless until they tampered with his sense of well-being and comfort. Now I fear I won't be able to hold him back. He is...
A quick, threatening gesture from Rhaefar's outstretched hand stifled Complacency's wailings.
I do not want Hogan held back, Rhaefar said. I want him destroyed. Yes. Take his daughter. Take anything else that can be corrupted. A risk is best removed, not tolerated.
But,
cried Complacency. But Rhaefar quickly took hold of him and spoke with noxious fumings right into his face.
Discourage him. Surely you can do that.
Well.
But Rhaefar was in no mood to wait for an answer. With a powerful spin of his wrist, he hurled Complacency out of the room and back to work.
We will destroy him, assault him on every side until he has no solid ground left from which to fight. As for this new man of God who has sprung up, I'm sure an adequate trap can be laid. But concerning our enemies, how strong are they?
Not strong at all,
answered Lucius, trying to recover his competency rating.
But cunning enough to make you think they are weak. A fatal mistake, Lucius.
He addressed all of them.
You are to no longer take the enemy for granted. Watch him. Count his numbers. Know his whereabouts, his skill, his name. No mission was ever undertaken that was not challenged by the hosts of heaven. And this mission is nothing small. Our Lord has very important plans for this town. He has sent me to fulfill them, and that is enough to draw the very hordes of the enemy down upon our heads. Be fearful of that, and give place nowhere. And as for these two thorns in our hoof, these two implanted barriers, tonight we will see what they are made of.
Chapter 6. It was a dark, rainy night, and the raindrops pelting against the old single-pane windows made sleep difficult for Hank and Mary. She dropped off eventually, but Hank, already troubled in spirit, found it much harder to relax. It had been a lousy day, anyway. He had worked on painting that slogan off the front of the house and tried to figure out who in the world would write such a thing against him. His ears were still ringing with the conversation he'd had with Alf Brummel, and his mind was still playing over and over the bitter comments from the board meeting. Now he could add to his apprehensions the congregational meeting on Friday, and he prayed to the Lord in desperate, hushed whispers as he lay there in the dark. Funny how every lump in the mattress seems so much more lumpy when you're upset. Hank began to worry that he would keep Mary awake with all his tossing and turning. He lay on his back, his side, his other side, put his arms under his pillow, over his pillow. He grabbed a Kleenex and blew his nose. He looked over at the clock. 12:20. They had turned in at 10. But sleep finally does come, usually in such an unannounced way that you don't even know you're out until you wake up. Sometime that night, Hank dozed off. But after a few hours, his dreams began to go sour. They were the usual silly things at first, like driving a car through his living room and then flying in the car as it turned into an airplane. But then the images began to rush and riot through his head, growing frantic and chaotic. He started running from dangers. He could hear screams. There was the sensation of falling and the sight and taste of blood. Images were from bright and colorful to monochromatic and dismal. He was constantly fighting, struggling for his life. Innumerable dangers and enemies surrounded him, closing in. None of it made any sense. But one thing was very definite throughout. Stark terror. He wanted desperately to scream, but didn't have time between fighting off enemies, monsters, unseen forces. His pulse began to pound in his ears. The whole world was reeling and throbbing. The horrible conflict rushing in his head began to push its way to the surface of the conscious, everyday Hank. He stirred in the bed, rolled over on his back, drew a deep waking-up breath. His eyes half-opened, not focused on anything. He was in that strange state of stupor halfway between sleep and consciousness. Did he really see it? It was an eerie projection in midair, a glowing painting on black velvet. Right above the bed, so close he could smell sulphurous breath, a hideous mask of a face hovered, contorting in grotesque movements as it spit out vicious words he couldn't understand. Hank's eyes opened like a sprung trap. He thought he could still see the face, just fading away, but instantly he felt like he'd been struck by a very heavy blow to his chest. His heart began to race and pound like it would burst through his ribs. He could feel his pajamas and the bedsheets sticking to him, drenched in sweat. He lay there panting for breath, waiting for his heart to calm down, for the stark terror to go away. But nothing changed, and he couldn't make it change. "You're just having a nightmare," he kept telling himself. But he couldn't seem to wake up. He purposely opened his eyes wide and looked around the darkened room, even though part of him wanted to regress back to childhood and just hide under the covers until the ghosts and monsters and burglars went away. He saw nothing in the room out of the ordinary. A goblin in the corner was nothing but his shirt hanging on a chair, and the strange halo of light on the wall was only the street light reflecting off the crystal of his watch. But he had been severely frightened, and he was still scared. He could feel himself shaking as he desperately tried to sort hallucination from reality. He watched, listened. Even the silence seemed sinister. He found no comfort in it, only the dread that something evil hid behind it, an intruder or a demon waiting, watching for the right moment. What was that? A creak in the house? Footsteps? No, he told himself, just the wind against the windows. The rain had stopped. Another noise, this time a rustling in the living room. He had never heard that noise at night before. I gotta wake up, I gotta wake up. Come on, heart, quiet down so I can hear. He forced himself to sit up in bed, even though it made him feel more vulnerable. And he remained there for several minutes, trying to stifle his heart's pounding with his hand over his chest. The pounding finally settled back a little, but the rate remained rapid. Hank could feel the sweat turning cold against his skin. To get up or go back to sleep? Sleep was definitely out. He decided to get up, look around, walk it off. A clatter this time in the kitchen. Now Hank started praying. Marshall had had the same kind of dreams and felt the same heart-pounding fear. Voices. It sure sounded like voices somewhere. Sandy? Maybe a radio. But who knows, he thought to himself. This town is going crazy anyway, and now the sickies are in my house. He slid stealthily out of bed, put on his slippers, and moved over to the closet to procure a baseball bat. Just like back home, he thought. Now somebody's going to have mush for brains. He looked out his bedroom door, up and down the hallway. No lights were on anywhere. No flashlight beams played about. But his guts were doing a square dance under his ribs, and there had to be some reason for it. He reached for the hallway light and flipped the switch. Nuts! The bulb was burnt out. Since when, he didn't know, but he stood in the dark and felt his courage deflated just that much more. He gripped the bat more tightly and moved down the hall, staying close to the wall, looking ahead, looking behind, listening. He thought he could hear a quiet rustling somewhere, something moving. At the archway that led into the living room, his eyes caught something, and he pressed himself against the wall for concealment. The front door was open. Now his heart really started pounding, thudding rudely in his ears. In a strange jungle way, he felt better. At least there was indication of a real enemy. It was this lousy fear without any reason that was spooking him. He had already been through that sort of thing once today. With that thought came a strange idea. That professor lady must be in the house. He moved down the hall to check Sandy's room and make sure she was all right. He wanted to stay between Kate and Sandy and whatever's out there in the rest of the house. Sandy's bedroom door was open, and that was unusual. It made him all the more cautious. He inched along the wall toward the doorway, and then, bat ready in his hands, he peered into the room. Something was up. Sandy was, at least. Her bed was empty, and she was gone. He flicked on her bedroom light. The bed had been slept in, but now the covers were thrown back hastily, and the room was in disarray. As Marshall moved cautiously down the darkened hallway, it did occur to him that Sandy might just be up getting a drink, using the bathroom, reading. But such simple logic weakened against the horrible feeling that something was dreadfully wrong. He took deep breaths, trying with his greatest effort to hold himself steady, while all the time he felt an insidious, unearthly terror, as if he were inches from the crushing teeth of some monster he couldn't see. The bathroom was cold and dark. He turned on the light, dreading what he thought he might see. He saw nothing out of the ordinary. He left that light on and headed back toward the living room. He peered like some kind of stalking fugitive through the archway. There was that rustling sound again. He flipped on the lights. Ah, the cold night air was coming in through the front door, rustling the drapes. No, Sandy was nowhere to be seen. Not in the living room, not anywhere in or near the kitchen. Perhaps she was right outside. But he had undeniable qualms about crossing the living room to the front door, walking past all the furniture that could hide an assailant. He gripped the bat tightly, keeping it up and ready. He kept his back to the wall as he made his way around the perimeter of the room, stepping around the sofa after checking behind it, hurriedly maneuvering around the stereo and finally reaching the door. He went out onto the porch, into the cool night air, and for some reason suddenly felt safer. The town was still quiet this time of night. Everyone else was certainly asleep right now, not sneaking around their houses with baseball bats. He took a moment to regather himself and then went back inside. Locking the door behind him was just like shutting himself in a dark closet with a couple of hundred vipers. The fear returned, and he tightened his grip on the bat. With his back against the door, he looked around the room again. Why was it so dark? The lights were on, but every bulb seemed so dim, as if there were some kind of brownout. Hogan, he thought to himself, either you've really lost a screw or you're in big, big trouble. He remained frozen there by the door, motionless, looking and listening. There had to be somebody or something in the house. He couldn't hear them or see them, but he could certainly feel them. Outside the house, lying low in the evergreens and hedges, Tal and his company watched as demons, at least 40 according to Tal's count, played havoc with Marshall's mind and spirit. They swooped like deadly black swallows in and out of the house, through the rooms, around and around Marshall, screaming taunts and blasphemies and playing with and ever-increasing his fears. Tal kept careful watch for the dreaded Rhaefar, but the Baal wasn't among this wild group. There could be no doubt, however, that Rhaefar had sent them. Tal and the others agonized, feeling Marshall's pain. One demon, an ugly little imp with bristling, needle-sharp quills all over his body, leaped upon Marshall's shoulders and beat upon his head, screaming, "You're going to die, Hogan! You're going to die! Your daughter is dead, and you are going to die!" Gilo could hardly control himself. His big sword slipped with a metallic ring from its sheath, but Tal's strong arm held him back.
"Please, Captain," Gilo pleaded. "Never before have I only watched this happen."
"Bridle yourself, dear warrior," Tal cautioned.
"I will strike them only once."
Gilo could see that even Tal was severely pained by his own order.
"Forbear, forbear. He must go through it."
Hank had the lights on in the house, but he thought his eyes must have been playing tricks on him because the room still looked very dark, the shadows deep. Sometimes he couldn't tell if it was himself moving or the shadows in the room. A strange undulating motion in the light and shadows made the depths in the house shift back and forth like the slow, steady motion of breathing. Hank stood in the doorway between kitchen and living room, watching and listening. He thought he could feel a wind moving through the house, but not a cold one from outside. It was like hot, sticky breath laden with repulsive odors, close and oppressive. He had discovered that the clatter in the kitchen was due to a spatula sliding off the drain board and onto the floor. That should have calmed his nerves right down, but he still felt terrified. He knew that he would sooner or later have to come into the living room to have a look. He took his first step out of the doorway and into the room. It was like falling into a bottomless well of blackness and terror. The hairs on his neck bristled as if with static electricity. His lips started spilling out a frantic prayer. He went down. Before he even knew what was happening, his body pitched forward and slammed onto the floor. He became a trapped animal, instinctively struggling, trying to get loose from the unseen crushing weight that held him. His arms and legs were smacking into furniture and knocking things over, but in his terror and shock he felt no pain. He squirmed, twisted, gasped for breath, and lashed out at whatever it was, feeling resistance against the motion of his arms like stroking through water. The room seemed filled with smoke. Blackness like blindness, a loss of hearing, a loss of contact with the real world, time standing still. He could feel himself dying. An image, a hallucination, a vision, or a real sight broke through for an instant, two ghastly yellow eyes full of hate. His throat began to compress, squeezing shut.
"Jesus," he heard his mind cry out, "help me."
His next thought, a tiny instant flash, must have come from the Lord. "Rebuke it. You have the authority." Hank spoke the words, though he couldn't hear the sound of them.
"I rebuke you in Jesus' name."
The crushing weight upon him lifted so quickly, Hank felt he would sail upward from the floor. He filled his lungs with air and noticed he was now struggling against nothing. But the terror was still there. The black, sinister presence. He sat up halfway, drew another breath, and spoke it clearly and loudly.
"In the name of Jesus, I command you to get out of this house."
Mary awoke with a jerk, startled and then terrified by the sound of a multitude screaming in anguish and pain. The cries were deafening at first, but they faded as if moving off into the unseen distance.
"Hank!"
she screamed. Marshall roared like a savage and raised the bat high to strike down his attacker. The attacker screamed also out of stark terror. It was Kate. They had unknowingly backed into each other in the dark hallway.
"Marshall!"
she exclaimed, and her voice quivered. She was close to tears and angry at the same time.
"What on earth are you doing out here?"
"Kate," Marshall sighed, feeling himself shrink like a punctured inner tube. "What are you trying to do, get yourself killed?"
"What's wrong?"
She was looking at the baseball bat and knew something was up. She clung to him in fear.
"Is there someone in the house?"
"No," he muttered in a combination of relief and disgust. "Nobody. I looked."
"What happened? Who was it?"
"Nobody," I said.
"But I thought you were talking to someone."
He looked at her with the utmost impatience and said with steadily building volume, "Do I look like I've been having a friendly chat with someone?" Kate shook her head.
"I must have been dreaming, but it was the voices that woke me up."
"What voices?"
"Marshall, it sounded like a New Year's Eve party in there. Come on, who was it?"
"Nobody. There wasn't anybody here. I looked." Kate was very flustered.
"I know I was awake."
"You heard ghosts." He could feel her hand squeezing the blood out of his arm.
"Don't talk like that."
"Sandy's gone."
"What do you mean, gone? Gone where?"
"She's gone. Her room's empty. She's not in the house. She's, poof, gone." Kate hurried down the hall and looked in Sandy's room. Marshall followed her and observed from the doorway as Kate checked the room over, looking through the closet and some of the drawers. She reported with alarm,
"Some of her clothes are gone. Her school books are missing."
She looked at him helplessly.
"Marshall, she's left home."
He looked back at her for a long moment, then around the room, then rested his head against the door jamb with a quiet thud. "Nuts," he said.
"I knew she wasn't herself tonight.
I should have found out what was wrong.
We didn't hit it off too well today.
Well, that was obvious. You came home without her.
How'd she get home, anyway?
Her girlfriend Terry brought her.
Maybe she went over to Terry's for the night.
Should we call and find out?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Marshall closed his eyes and tried to think.
No, it's late. Either she's there or she isn't. If she isn't, we'll be getting them out of bed for nothing, and if she is, well, she's okay anyway.
Kate seemed a little panicked.
I'm going to call.
Marshall held up his hand and leaned his head against the door jamb again as he said,
Hey, don't get all spooked now, all right? Give me a minute.
I just want to see if she's there.
All right, all right.
But Kate could see something was very wrong with Marshall. He was pale, weak, shaken.
What's the matter, Marshall?
Give me a minute.
She put her arm around him, concerned.
What is it?
He had quite a struggle getting it out.
I'm scared.
Trembling a bit, his eyes closed, his head resting against the door jamb, he said again,
I'm really scared, and I don't know why.
That scared Kate.
Marshall?
Don't get upset, will you? Keep it level.
Can I do anything?
Just be tough, that's all.
Kate thought for a moment.
Well, why don't you get your robe on? I'll warm you some milk, okay?
Yeah, great.
It was the first time any demons had ever been actually confronted and rebuked by Hank Bush. They had certainly come with an arrogant brashness at first, descending on the house in the dead of night to raid and ravage, screaming and swooping through the rooms and leaping on Hank, trying to terrify him. But as Creone, Triskull, and the others watched from their hiding place, confused and scattered flocks of demons suddenly came thundering and fluttering out of the house like bats, screaming, indignant, stopping their ears. There must have been close to 100, all the usual demonic pranksters and troublemakers Creone had seen at work all over the town. No doubt the great Baal had sent them. And now that they had been routed, there was no telling what Rhaefar's reaction or his next plan would be. But Hank had proven himself very well. In a moment the coast was clear, the trouble was over, and the warriors came out of hiding, breathing easier. Creone and Triskull were impressed. Creone commented,
Tal was right. He's not so insignificant.
Triskull agreed,
Stern stuff, this Henry Bush.
But as Hank and Mary sat trembling at their kitchen table, she preparing an ice pack and he sporting a welt on his forehead and a great many bruises and scrapings on his arms and shins, neither one of them felt entirely stern, powerful, or victorious. Hank was thankful to have escaped with his life, and Mary was still in a mild state of shock and disbelief. It was awkward, with neither of them wanting to relate his or her experiences first, for fear that the whole thing was nothing but an excess of pickles and pastrami before bedtime. But Hank's welt kept growing, and he could only tell what he knew. Mary bought every word of it, scared as she was by the screams that had awakened her. As they shared their not-so-pleasant experiences, they were able to accept the fact that the whole night of madness had been very frighteningly real and not some nightmare.
Demons, Hank concluded.
Mary could only nod.
But why?
Hank pleaded to know.
What was it for?
Mary wasn't ready to come up with any answers. She kept waiting for Hank to do that. He muttered,
Like lesson number one in front lines combat. I wasn't a bit ready for it. I think I flunked.
Mary gave him the ice pack, and he placed it against the welt, wincing at the pressure.
What makes you think you flunked?
She asked.
I don't know. I just walked into it, I guess. I let them clobber me.
Then he prayed,
Lord God, help me to be ready next time.
Give me the wisdom, the sensitivity to know what they're up to.
Mary squeezed his hand and said, Amen, and then commented,
You know, I might be wrong, but hasn't the Lord already done that? I mean, how are you going to know how to fight Satan's direct attacks unless you just do it?
That was what Hank needed to hear.
Wow, he mused. I'm a veteran. And I don't think you flunked, either. They're gone, aren't they? And you're still here, and you should have heard those screams.
Are you sure it wasn't me?
Quite sure.
Then came a long, troubled silence.
So, what now? Mary finally asked. Let's pray, said Hank.
For him, that option was always easy to jump to. And pray they did, clasping hands at the little kitchen table, having a conference with the Lord. They thanked him for the experience of that night, for protecting them from danger, for showing them a very close glimpse of their enemy. Over an hour passed, and during that time the field of concern continued to grow outward. Their own problems began to take a small place in a vastly wider perspective as Hank and Mary prayed for their church, the people in it, the town, the people that ran it, the state, the nation, the world. Through it all came the beautiful assurance that they had indeed connected with the throne of God and had conducted serious business with the Lord. Hank grew more determined to stay in the battle and give Satan a real run for his money. He was sure that was what God wanted. The warm milk and Kate's company had a soothing effect on Marshall's nerves. With each swallow and each additional minute of normalcy, he gained more and more assurance that the world would still go on. He would live. The sun would rise in the morning. He was amazed at how bleak things had looked just a little while ago.
"Feeling better?"
Kate asked, buttering some fresh toast. "Yeah," he answered, noticing that his heart had retreated back into his chest and returned to its normal everyday pace. "Boy, I don't know what got into me." Kate placed the two slices of toast on a plate and set them on the table. Marshall crunched off a bite of toast and asked,
"So she's not at Terry's?"
Kate shook her head.
"Do you want to talk about Sandy?"
Marshall was ready.
"We probably need to talk about a lot of things."
"I don't know how to start."
"You think it's my fault?"
"Oh, Marshall."
"Come on, be honest now. I've been getting my behind whipped off all day. I'll listen."
Her eyes met his and remained in place, denoting a sincerity and firm love.
"Categorically, no," she said.
"I botched it today."
"I think we've all botched it, and that includes Sandy. She's made some choices, too, remember?"
"Yeah, but maybe it was because we didn't have anything better to give her."
"What do you think of talking to Pastor Young?"
"Case in point."
"Hmm?"
Hogan shook his head despondently.
Maybe Young's just a little too cush, you know. He's into all this family of man stuff, discovering yourself, saving the whales."
Kate was a little surprised.
"I thought you liked Pastor Young."
"Well, I guess I do, but sometimes... No, a lot of the time. I don't even feel like I'm going to church. I may as well be sitting at a lodge meeting or in one of Sandy's weird classes."
He checked her eyes. They were still steady. She was listening.
"Kate, don't you ever get the feeling that God's got to be, you know, a little bigger, tougher? The God we get at that church, I feel like he isn't even a real person. And if he is, he's dumber than we are. I can't expect Sandy to buy that stuff. I don't even go for it myself."
"I never knew you felt this way, Marshall."
"Well, maybe I never did either. It's just that this thing tonight, I really got to think about it. There's been so much of it going on lately."
What do you mean? What's been going on?
I can't tell her, Marshall thought to himself. How could he explain the strange hypnotic persuasion he was sure he got from Brummell, the spooky feelings he'd gotten from Sandy's professor, the stark terror he'd felt that night? None of it made sense. And now, to top it off, Sandy was gone. All through these situations he had been horrified by his own inability to fight back. He had felt controlled. But he couldn't tell Kate anything like that.
It's a long story, he said finally. All I know is this whole thing, our lifestyle, our schedule, our family, our religion, whatever it is, just isn't working. Something's got to change.
But you don't think you want to talk to Pastor Young?
He's a turkey.
Just then, 1 a.m. or not, the phone rang.
Sandy! Kate exclaimed.
Marshall snatched up the receiver.
Hello?
Hello, said a female voice. You're up.
Marshall recognized the voice with disappointment. It was Bernice.
Oh, hi, Bernie, he said, looking at Kate, whose face sank now with frustration.
Don't hang up. I'm sorry for calling at this late hour, but I had a date and I didn't get home until late. But I wanted to develop that film. Are you mad?
I'll be mad tomorrow. Right now I'm too tired. What have you got?
Get this. I know the film and the camera had 12 pictures of the carnival, including the ones of Brummell Young and those three unknowns. Today I went home and shot the rest of the roll, 12 more frames. My cat, the neighbor lady with the big mole, the evening news, etc. Today's pictures came out.
There was a pause, and Marshall knew he would have to ask. What about the other ones?
The emulsion was blacked out, totally exposed. The film scratched and fingerprinted in a few places. There's nothing wrong with the camera.
Marshall said nothing for a long moment.
Marshall? Hello?
That's interesting, he said.
They're up to something. It's got me all excited. I'm wondering if I can trace those prints.
There was another long pause.
Hello?
What did the other woman look like? The blonde one?
Not too old, long blonde hair, kind of mean looking.
Heavy, thin, in between?
She looked good.
Marshall's forehead crinkled a bit, and his eyes shifted about as he followed his ideas.
I'll see you in the morning.
Goodbye, and thanks for answering.
Marshall hung up the phone. He stared at the tabletop, drumming his fingers.
What was that all about? Kate asked.
He said, still thinking. Then he answered, newspaper stuff, no biggie. What was it we were talking about, anyway?
Well, if it still matters, we were just talking about whether or not you should talk to Pastor Young about our problem.
Young, he said, and almost sounded angry.
But if you don't want to...
Marshall stared at the table while his warm milk got cold. Kate waited, then roused him with,
Would you rather talk about this in the morning?
I'll talk to him, Marshall said flatly. I want to talk to him. You bet I'll talk to him.
It couldn't hurt.
No, it sure couldn't.
I don't know when he'd be able to see you, but...
1 o'clock would be nice. He scowled a bit. 1 o'clock would be perfect.
Marshall, Kate started.
But she kept it back. There was something happening to her husband, and she picked it up in his voice and his expression. She had never really missed that fire in his eyes. Perhaps she'd never known it was gone until this moment, when, for the first time since they left New York, she saw it again. Some old, unpleasant feelings rose up within her, feelings she had no desire to cope with late at night with her daughter mysteriously missing.
Marshall,
she said, sliding her chair out and picking up the plate of half-eaten toast,
let's get some sleep.
I may not be able to sleep.
I know.
she said quietly. All this time, Tal, Gilo, Nathan, and Armoth had stood in the room, carefully observing, and now Gilo began to chuckle in his gruff, quaking way. Tal said with a smile, "No, Marshal Hogan, you never were much of a sl-"